Hey everybody, before we get started, I just wanted to jump on because we are so excited to announce that Restore registration is officially open. We can't wait to be with you again this year. It's going to be on September 5th through 7th at the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. That's the evening of September 5th and then all day on the 6th and the 7th. 3 days of incredible speakers, poets, musicians, and artists. We really think that what we have planned will blow you away again this year, so you won't want to miss it. Go to faithmatters.org/restore for tickets and we'll see you there. Hey everybody, this is Aubrey Chaffis from Faith Matters. This week we sat down with Kathy Kipp Clayton and Bill Turnbull to talk about the fascinating chapters they contributed to a new book entitled No Division Among You, Creating Unity in a Diverse Church. Bill and his wife Susan are two of the Faith Matters co-founders, and Kathy and her husband Whitney, who served in the presidency of the 70 until 2020, have served around the world on church assignments for the past 2 decades. They now supervise and often travel the world with the Tabernacle Choir. Kathy is an author and an education innovator. In their essays, Kathy and Bill share how the everyday, sometimes uncomfortable situations we find ourselves in at church can be a profound opportunity to get curious about what others are seeing, especially when we don't see eye to eye with them. And they talk through their own experiences learning to love people that they didn't expect to love, and finding ways to open themselves to questions rather than to fear, to look at differences or aberrations from the norm as ways to connect. At a time when in-person gatherings, clubs, and associations are in decline across society, these experiences that we have with others at church might be increasingly rare and important. We really hope that you enjoy this conversation with Bill and Kathy. All right. Well, Bill and Kathy, thank you so much for being here with us. It's really fun to have you both in the studio. We're excited to do this.
Delighted.
We love this book. We love this topic. I was thinking that this topic of unity really is underneath every conversation I think that we have at Faith Matters. It's the conversation we're always having, no matter the topic. And so it's fun to be able to invite you both and have a conversation more directly about something that we care so much about. I wonder, maybe Bill, you can start. Can you just tell us a little bit about what the book is and how it got started?
Sure. Well, yeah, our mutual friend, Richard Iyer, I think it was sort of something that he thought was important to do, and partnered with Deseret Book in sort of bringing it forth. Partly in response to President Nelson's call for us to become peacemakers in the world. Yeah. And I think that we're looking at a stretch here in the very near future when peace may be hard to find and division may become even more common. So these are essays from different perspectives by quite different people. There's a pretty good diversity. We have a couple of Black Latter-day Saints. We have Kim Teeter and Ronell Hugh. We have Ben Shalati, so a gay Latter-day Saint. We have, Richard tried to find Latter-day Saints of all stripes and say, what is our experience in our community and in the world? And how can we help each other better see each other?
Yeah.
And bring, rather than judgment, bring more curiosity to the experience of others. So they're short essays, briefish essays, and from these different perspectives. And I think maybe we can all see ourselves in one or more of these essays.
I could add a little theoretical thought to that great description. I knew some of these people before and considered them friends. Others were completely unfamiliar to me, but that was part of the beauty of it. Was that there were familiar people and totally unfamiliar people, but our commitment was to becoming friends. In a very broad sense of the word, we didn't have any pre-assigned topics except for the very broad theme of unity. And that was kind of wonderful and liberating in its own right, because all ideas were brought to the table. They were all welcome and invited formally by the invitation from Rick Iyer in the very first place. And then in my opinion, one of the best things that happened was after the book was completed, we were... Well, actually, a step before that, as each of us finished our personal essay, we'd circulate it to the group, and then others would respond. Sometimes there'd be pushback or request for clarification or even some taking issue with some of the things we might have written. Sometimes there was applause or enthusiastic response or, wow, that's a great idea I'd never thought of. There was some of both, I think, for all of us. Sometimes there was a lot of response, sometimes just a little. But that was probably as valuable as the original composition. And everybody received that feedback and pushback and encouragement with civility and gratitude. Yeah. And the essays became better in the process. So for me, the process of the refinement of the essays that occurred in the collaboration of the group of friends and new friends was as valuable as the original composition. Wow. And then at the end, we were asked to think of questions that we might ask ourselves or somebody else about those, and include those at the conclusion of ours, of our personal essays. And that too was valuable insofar as seeking and requiring ourselves to go a little farther with what else might I need to know, or what else might someone think of. So the very process of the collaboration was part of the process of the unity and of the achieving no divisions among us.
Yeah, love that. I'm curious. I mean, both of you are obviously very busy people. What is it about? What is it that you're seeing in the world or in the church or in our communities that made you say yes to this project and take this on? Kathy, do you want to start?
Thank you. Yes, I would. I'm happy to. Thanks for the question. It seems to me that our modern world has fewer automatic overlaps of interaction among diverse people than it used to. In the very most pragmatic ways, I mean, malls are disappearing. Mm-hmm. I used to love rubbing shoulders with other moms pushing strollers at malls, people I never knew. I'd tie their kids' shoelaces. And there was a certain synergy and sameness and cooperation among total strangers that I think was binding. There are no more bowling leagues or rotary clubs, or I don't know, maybe some of those things exist, but they're fast disappearing. Even reading the same books, even a common core at schools has disappeared. We're so eclectic that I think we've lost a connection. Mm. And I love the idea of drilling down on that concept of reclaiming connection, unity, however we might find it and however we might see it, particularly in this modern moment when I think the default is diversity rather than unity.
Yeah, interesting. Bill, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that. It's very easy now. It's just so easy to have everything brought to you. Information and the way we receive information, the way we interact with other people, these are like very closely self-selected communities now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're not really challenged to get outside of ourselves.
And often digital communities.
Often digital communities, right. And so she's right. I never thought about malls as like this opportunity, like a spiritual practice, the soulless mall.
Shopping is spiritual practice. Yes.
But it was a way to connect people a little bit. But it is true. Now we have Amazon. Everything's just like, it comes to us. So they're just, I think that's absolutely true. We may have something unique to offer in our faith in that regard, which we can talk about later.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about how so in the very beginning, I think it's like in the foreword, Richard Iyer talks about how division and discord, it's a malignant problem because it feeds itself. Like when there's a little bit, then it can spread. And I can see how the opposite is also true, that when you feel unified in connection, that feels kind of contagious in the best way too. But I'm thinking about this meta experience you guys had in creating unity in the process of creating the book and like getting some pushback and maybe like critiques of your own ideas. And for me, I think that's usually when I stop feeling unity. It's usually and maybe I'm not sure which one comes first. Maybe there's a bigger issue that comes first, but I feel the most separated from the group when I feel like there's a moment of divide where I've been pushed away or I feel like an idea or I've been critiqued. And so can you talk about that experience of choosing to be open, like choosing to be part of a group where you're going to get some pushback and choosing to stay anyway? Because I know in a really personal way that the tempting thing is to just find a new group that likes my essay, you know?
Sure. You know, there was a vulnerability about that. I admit when I'd see the critiques come across, I had to kind of take a deep breath and make sure I'd had a good night's rest before I opened that message.
Yeah.
Because there was a vulnerability. Yeah. And I think some people feel that more profoundly than others. I'm with you, Aubrey. I feel that very deeply. I have a hard time not being wounded and fetal position it after a critique. But if I was well rested and the time was right and my heart was open, then I found that I was more ready to receive that. So timing mattered for me, which seems a silly thing, but it did matter. Additionally, within the context of this group, there was appetite for variety. So at the end of the day, if I felt like I read that critique and I respected it, I didn't have to adopt it. Mm. I might think, you know, I understand where he's coming from and I appreciate it and I admire his thought and that may resonate with him. But in the final analysis, this is my essay, and I'm gonna keep that sentence as it is. I still own that. Yeah. Or I might tinker with it just a little, just to refine it and perfect it and improve it. But I didn't need to be wholly wedded to my original thought. But by the same token, I could still claim it. So there was space to retain what I felt to retain, but to be open and vulnerable enough to refine and improve it, which was almost always the case as a result of something that someone else noticed or failed or understood as he or she read it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's.
I'm curious, maybe we could dive into a little bit, maybe some terminology. And also I would like to get at what the goal is of not just of the book, but of what we're trying to do here in community. And I think there are some potentially competing terms that would be good to get straight. So sameness, you know, is one thing. Unity potentially is another thing. Diversity is one thing. Division potentially is another thing. So what are, maybe Bill, do you want to start here? Like, what are we actually trying to get at? Is sameness a part of it, or can unity be completely separate from sameness?
Yeah, I mean, in this enterprise and in our enterprise at Faith Matters, I think sameness is definitely not the goal. So yeah, and I think every essay, this book was conceived as an exercise in diversity, you know, affirming diversity, and but I think contention is probably what we're trying to avoid here, right?
Yeah.
It's like there's a way to disagree and to look at things like there's a way to make room for lots of different kinds of worldviews and not be contentious about it. But there's a way, this is Governor Cox's disagree better initiative, right? He's not saying, let's not disagree. Let's disagree. And let's respect each other in the process. And maybe, just maybe, we can learn something. And so, yeah, I think that's incredibly important. We really do need to learn this, because there is a lot of contention. There's a lot of estrangement that's occurring. More, I think we were talking about this just before, but new statistics emerging on the level of estrangement, even among families, even within families. It's unprecedented in our society. Why is this happening? Why are we not able to disagree? Why are we not able to have, you know, distinct views about the world and not be able to transcend those around something maybe larger, a larger identity, a larger purpose? And why is this division? This book is addressing a real issue that we have, not only in society where it's obvious, but also at the micro level of families and personal relationships.
Yeah.
May I give an example?
Please.
I think this book is very artfully entitled No Division Among Us, not No Diversity Among Us. Mm-hmm. And the terms are dramatically different. Yeah. The diversity, yes, bring it on. The division, no. So it involves a pulling back to eliminate the division, but to embrace the diversity, to find the things that unite us and shun the things that divide us. An example, we lived for 27 years in Southern California. All of our kids were born and raised there. During that time, for many of those years, seven of those years, my husband was serving as a bishop in a ward 30 miles from our house. Lots of overlap. It was a Latino ward, a Spanish-speaking ward in Santa Ana, California. We lived in Irvine, and this ward was in Santa Ana. Anyway, that ward included all Spanish speakers. That was the unification, was the Spanish speaking. But even that had its diversity among it as a result of vernacular and accent. So they were united by, they liked to say, divided by a common tongue, they would say. They were united by it, but there were also divisions within, just because of terminology and accent. During the early days of the formation, he was there from the time of the beginning of that little branch until it became a thriving ward and eventually a stake. During the early days, there was so much attention to the division that it was hard to unite around that language and something larger, something bigger than any single member of the branch. And there had to be great care taken by the leaders, for example, when calling a presidency, to make sure that there was a representative from three different countries in any given presidency, so that nobody felt like there was a hierarchy and one country was elevated above another, the diversity issue. But as time went on and those people were united in a common cause, which is not at all common, that's the cause of Christ, then the division dissipated. The diversity was embraced and their various points of view were celebrated and honored and championed and worked to the good of the whole. And the division, the divisiveness just dissipated. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter. They were all united. And I like to say that that's the culture of Christ, that that's the unifier. If we can just pull back from our own personal cultures, the ones that are divisive, or our own personal inclinations, whatever they may be, to unite under a culture of Christ, it's a whole different story. Then we're not so beating our own drum, but we're playing the same music. And the variety of sounds is more beautiful than would be any single sound alone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I don't know how to ask this exactly, but what I keep wanting to ask you is, do you think that there needs to be unity about the most important reason to be unified? You know, like I think that can sometimes be the problem, that maybe we don't feel like we're all getting behind the same cause. And so that feels like a reason to be divided. And so I like the idea that the fact that we speak Spanish, that's the reason that we're going to be unified. Like, does it need to be a noble, a overarching cause that we can all get on board with? Do you know what I mean? Or is the fact that we are neighbors reason enough to choose unity? Or the fact that we are members of this same country or this same church or this same street in a neighborhood, like, is that enough reason to be unified? Because I think so much of the problem feels like it's rooted down so deep that we can't even agree on what we should be unified together under. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
So like, is that just not even what matters? Is unity the culture of Christ? And so it doesn't matter if we all agree with it, with anything else. We're just going to choose to be together and we're going to choose to be neighborly.
I would suggest that I think most commonly when we're feeling this disunity, we drill down on our own identity. When the solution would be to pull back to a broader identity that's more inclusive.
Wow, that's a really good way to put it.
So in this Spanish branch ward stake, they pulled back as they grew to be ever more disciple-like to a unity that was the culture of Christ. And then that liberated them to be more themselves in smaller ways, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest that as we become more Christ-like in our own hearts, more allegiant to the Prince of Peace, then peace is more our disposition. But in the meantime, which is probably all the way through our mortal sojourn and the mortal man, the natural man within us all, tends to take over too often. The wisest strategy is to pull back until we find the commonness.
Wow.
So the highest level commonness would be sons and daughters of God, right? And there may be certain relationships where there's nothing at a lower level that feels unifying, but that one will always be. And then as the relationship and the synergy becomes more spontaneous and more affectionate and more understanding, then we can go down to lower levels and share and unify on lower levels of being and understanding.
Yeah. That is so wise. I love that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me drill down on that just a little bit too. I've been thinking about what the fault lines are that we could maybe explore in our families, in the church, in our broader communities. And I do think that I love what you just brought up, especially in a church community or even among religious people. We can sort of like keep zooming out until we get to, we're all children of God. And that really works for me because I do identify that way. But I guess one of the fault lines that I worry about, though, is the fault line between Latter-day Saints and former Latter-day Saints. Hmm. People who no longer necessarily identify as followers of Christ, or even in some cases, they may have ceased to believe in God. And so they don't identify that way anymore. This is, as part of the Faith Matters Project, I feel like this is just someone who is living a normal Latter-day Saint life that has friends and family members who have left the church. And I want to feel as connected with them as I ever have. How do we bridge that gap if we're not actually seeing that same unifying God, I guess is the only way to say it really.
That's a really interesting question. So I think that the things that tend to drive wedges between us tend to be things in the mind, actually. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the, Kathy just brought this up in her comment. She talked about it, this is really a heart matter. If to feel someone, it's one thing to say, oh, we're children of God. That sounds like an intellectual proposition. It's one thing. It's another thing to actually feel it. And we have to feel it. It has to come from the heart. So if we are living our life more from our heart rather than from our mind, which makes all kinds of divisions, that's sort of the mind's job, right? It's going out there. It's making distinctions. It's helping us navigate the world better, maybe based on those distinctions. But we also, we can also become slave to the mind and the slave to these ideas that tend to divide us. This is why people form along political ideological fault lines. This is all about ideas, right? And it tends to be the things that we tend to get lost in, whether it's online communities or, you know, you name it. These are always appeals to these distinctions. They're always appealing to these constructs of the mind that divide us and take us away from that unitive sort of experience of the heart. So it has to start at the heart level, and we have to live through our hearts if we really want to bridge divides. Mm. So I think that when I heard you say heart, that's it.
Agreed. Bill, can I ask you to share the story that you open with in your essay? It feels like it's very connected to what you're saying right now.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. I had an experience I know that not everyone has these experiences, but I also know that a lot of people do in various ways, but I had an experience when I was 18 years old, and it was a time when I was like most young people. I had lived my life primarily, it was my ego in charge. I was, and it's a natural developmental path to let your ego assert itself in the world. But at some point you're like living as this. I had pretty good social relationships. I had a lot of friends, but the truth is, my ego was ruling my life. I had a set of beliefs, but I was experiencing life like most young people do. But I came to this point where I needed to decide whether I wanted to serve a mission. And I knew deep in my heart that I didn't have anything particular to share with the world. I mean, maybe a set of ideas that I found resonant. I wasn't sure what I believed. So I entered a period of fasting and prayer. And at the end of this, after 3 days of fasting, so it was like I was determined to know if God. I wasn't even sure that God existed, and I wasn't sure at all what I was supposed to do with my life. So I thought if I fast, and there's something about that process of fasting that during that process I felt that ego sort of dissolve a little bit, and humility sort of well up from within me. But I was taking the sacrament, went back to my home ward from college, and I was sitting in the back row, and I was, they were passing the sacrament to me. And as the deacon passed me that sacrament and I took the sacrament, I can't explain it other than just overwhelmed by something I had never experienced before, which is the only way I explain it, was overwhelmed by God's love. And immediately I felt this deep connection, not just with God, but with the people, these blue haired, back in the day, we had blue haired ladies. Like, I don't know what that was.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I didn't do it. My grandmother did.
Mine too. Old people in a congregation, they're just the old people. They're not like really people. You just can't even imagine that you share anything in common with them. But I knew their names. I'd grown up and they'd always sit in the back row. And I just felt to embrace them. And I felt this love like flowing through this chapel. And literally, like, we had these tilt out windows in the chapel. Out the windows of the chapel, and there was an old, this beautiful oak tree or maple tree, I believe, that you could kind of see out the window. And I felt my love embrace that tree. In that moment, I felt this deep sense of God's love and a deep connection. So after that, now I can tell you that the ego has all kinds of ways to reinsert itself back. But I can see that for a number of days and even weeks, I viewed the world differently. I experienced the world differently. I saw these very ordinary people that I'd always just they'd been in my neighborhood forever, suddenly were different kinds of people. I saw them as like not just unique, but really special. And we were the most ordinary of people. If you can see my neighborhood, it's like ordinary USA, right? And so I think God allows us, that was a heart experience. I think God can allow us these visions of what, of a deeper reality than we commonly experience. Just to say, hey, there is a deeper reality here. There is a deeper connection. And part of what religion and spirituality does is to, it should bring us along a normal developmental path where we go from this leaving our lives completely from our egos to experiencing life more as a sort of, there's sort of a sense of, well, I have a place that I hike to often, and it's an aspen grove. I love aspen groves. And you got all these, you know, every aspen tree is a little bit different. They look, you know, they're very similar. The truth is, as you know, the largest organisms on Earth are aspen groves. These aren't individual trees. These are all connected under. Now, I wonder if an aspen tree sits and looks at the aspen tree next to it and says, you know, judges that aspen tree as like, well, I'm this aspen tree. But in reality, it's all one tree. Yeah. But it's that connection is underground that we don't see it. We see it as individual trees. And I think we can, but in reality, it's all one organism. They're all connected in a really fundamental way. I think that is our reality as well, but it's very difficult to see. Yeah. So I think that experience helped me see that in a way. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much. I feel like heart knowing for me is so much about, it's so experiential. And sometimes I even approach heart knowing through the mind, like try to explain how it's different and differentiated, make some bullet points about if I'm in heart.
They're heart bullets though, so it's all good. Heart
But hearing this story is so helpful because I feel what you're talking about. Like I feel it. And I think that's an easier compass. And that's a better compass for that heart knowing experience. And like, I may not be able to explain what unity should look like through the heart, but I know like the feeling that feels right. And it's easier to lean into that than it is to try to explain my way into it. So thank you for sharing that story.
And also the power of the ego and the mind reasserting itself, even in light of that insight that I had, like it is our default, unfortunately. And we need to lean into like this heart experience. We have to learn. This is a skill to develop, but it's also the spiritual path. But it's very, very easy to get stuck in the mind because that's what's being fed to us all the time.
Absolutely. I really love the metaphor of the aspen grove, and I think that's gonna stick with me. However, I think there's something, it falls just a little bit short of the human experience as well, because there is something so unique that each of us bring. And maybe you could say that of the aspens too, but it's not as clear to see. And this is actually, Kathy, I want to go into your essay a little bit, the wonderful metaphor that you bring up of the word choir, because that illustrates so clearly the difference between unison and unity, and how all of those different voices are bringing are coming together to bring something that we couldn't experience otherwise. Could you talk about a little bit what you shared in your essay?
And you asked me why I had begun with that, why I originated with that. I think this concept of no division among you began as I reflected upon it. I considered way back to my early childhood when I grew up as a very believing hearted little girl, in a home where there was none of the gospel. My father was a Presbyterian. My mother was a member of the church, but not at all interested or attentive at that time. She had other kind of personal things going on. So in any event, I attended as myself. I was a beneficiary of a church right down the street. So I attended by myself from the time I was little on and felt entirely at home. I thought I belonged. How arrogant was I? I didn't go with any family or anybody else. I just pulled up a seat and I believed I belonged. And those people treated me as if I did. And I loved the word choir. Even as a young girl, an early teenager, I loved the word choir. I didn't need a formal invitation. I didn't even need to be able to sing. There was always a seat for me there and always a welcome. And they treated me like, again, I belonged. So the concept of it served me well, even as a young girl who in many head kinds of ways didn't belong. I was kind of an outsider. I'd never heard of a ward council. I'd never seen religious clothing. I was a newcomer to the place, but I thought I belonged. I never missed. I paid 12% tithing just in case.
Does that look like they owe you a refund, actually?
And the ward choir was just one of those demonstrative places where I fit right in. I knew where my chair was. I knew who my people were. And I sang loud. And probably too loud on reflection, but nobody said I did. I was just welcome and embraced. And they always seemed glad to see me. And that concept, I think, that's so well illustrated in metaphorical sense to me by the ward choir, I think is just golden, just golden. No one gets called or invited or kicked out or anything else. Even the director is just a volunteer. Nobody's paid. They're never very good.
There are no auditions.
There are no auditions, but they don't really need to be good in the musical sense of the word. That's really not the point. The point is the worship and the community and the people from among the ranks who are sitting up there in front. All of that is the message of the word choir, not the excellence of the music per se from a technical point of view. That just really doesn't matter. In fact, isn't everybody's favorite choir the primary kids? And the more mistakes they make, the more we love it because it's them we love, right? So I think that's the way church I would hope would be once we return from the seats in the front in the word choir down to the pews, that every single person is invited. Mm-hmm. There's no audition. There's no checklist of obligations. If you're there, you're welcome. Yeah. Whatever you're wearing, however you look, whatever your thoughts, wherever you are, you're welcome. There's a seat for you in this congregation. Yeah. And I would hope that that's the way it is. We all know word choirs where somebody sometimes sings too loudly. And it does kind of offend the sound. And there are times in our Sunday school classes where somebody says things that really are kind of objectionable. But on the other hand, it's not really about that as much as it is about that person. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, I think that person and that person's need to say that for whatever reason is more important than anything else.
Yeah.
And we can deal with that.
Yeah.
We're big enough and saintly enough and welcoming enough and open-hearted enough. We can deal with that. Now, that doesn't mean, following the example of the Savior, that there wouldn't be occasions to follow up, to offer additional points of view, to correct, to suggest just another way of seeing things, another way of doing things, to offer help. That would be appropriate on occasion without embarrassing or shaming that person who had something that he or she was dealing with. And by the same token, I don't think there's a single time when whatever anyone says doesn't provide me an opportunity to learn something. I don't think there's a single thing that anyone could say or a single thing that anyone could do that if I'm open-hearted and open-minded enough, I couldn't learn something from. But unfortunately, I think my own pushback, my own ego, my own defensiveness of my personal turf or my inclination gets in the way of my openness of heart and spirit. And I would hope that we would all be individually taking responsibility for our own hearts so that our personal pushback didn't compromise somebody else's prerogative to worship and to be and to find themselves in their own journey.
Yeah. Thank you.
We often react with fear, which is what I think you're saying. By the way, revelation to me, I've always gone by the motto that it takes a pretty good ward choir to beat an old ward choir at all. And Kathy convinced
you
me otherwise. And
that.
I know, and you convinced me otherwise. And I've actually I've now volunteered to be in our ward choir. the little gifts I have. Can I share a little experience? This happened just last Sunday in our sacrament meeting. A couple comes in, they're a little bit late. He's wearing like this gray hoodie, stonewashed, whatever, acid washed jeans. And she's got this like bright pink, sweater and like tie dye something. It's quite an outfit. It's like not what you expect to come in sacrament. they come in late, they sit down. What I notice immediately is that, whoever they sat down by, they reached over and shook their hands and recognized them. And I'm like, this is
who reached.
The visitors. We've never seen them before. Okay. They've never been to our congregation before, right?
But they initiated the greeting.
They initiated the greeting. Yeah. Also, I also noticed like the connection that they shared as they're clearly husband and wife or partners. And so, you know, it's like, they're almost like childlike in their kind of effusive love for both each other and for the people, which kind of makes us a little uncomfortable sometimes, right? And I was like, okay, this is, and then they, it happened to be fast meeting. So two or three testimonies in, the husband gets up and goes up the stand. And I just saw the reaction of people and noticed the reaction of myself. There was like a little bit of fear, like what is going to happen here? They don't look like everybody else. They don't like act like everybody else. And he proceeded to get up and give a, he got to the front and he shook the hands of the people on the stands. It's like, and he proceeded to get up and just give this beautiful expression of love for God and the Savior. And the truth, what he said was that day they were visiting and their car had gotten stuck and it was her birthday. And anyway, they had this particular experience that where they felt God's grace. And he said, I just had to come down to the church and find a meeting and just testify to the goodness of God. Right. And
were they Latter-day Saints? Did you get a
Latter-day
sense?
Saints? They were. Okay. Interestingly, so he's a convert. He had identified himself as a convert, a Jewish convert. He's been a member for a while, but he also said prayers in Hebrew, Jewish prayers in Hebrew, and then like at the end of his testimony, these brief little prayers, these Hebrew prayers, lovely, and then he translated them, and it was just completely out of the box and completely beautiful, just the most beautiful thing. And we needed that it just struck me that I'm sure that including the bishop and his counselors, you know, when they see him walk up, they're imagining what could happen here. Yeah. What are we afraid of? Why are we letting fear inform this experience at all? Why can't we do what Kathy just suggested? And I think we did. And I think we accepted his gifts and you know what? It could have been something else. It could have been something weird happened. And that's okay too. Like, so, you know, it's what are we afraid of? What's the worst thing that can happen? I think we let fear.
Is such a good point. I love that your essay, Kathy, and the part, especially where you talk about the soloist who is too loud, maybe with, you know, maybe it's their clothes, but or something that just is different. And you say, and that's just right. Like, that's exactly what we want. They're doing it just right. And like, maybe there's somebody who's tone deaf and they're just right. And it made me realize that I always think about Brené Brown and this concept of fitting in versus belonging. And I've always looked at that in a really, like in an individual way that I'm trying to not just change who I am so I fit in, but be who I am. So and really look for belonging. But I think I often ask other people to fit in. I want, because it makes me nervous, I want everybody else to fit in to what feels very comfortable to me. And I agree. Like, I think there's so much growth to be had when we can be a little bit brave and kind of extend our circle of comfort and grow a little bit. But it really is uncomfortable on a Sunday when you just have a rhythm and you know what to expect. And I think you're totally right that it's fear popping up that makes us, that brings out the worst in our egos, right? And so I'm thinking about what you said about Sunday school and how maybe we're big enough to be able to sort of love this comment that is actually hurtful. Like when there's something that is like, this is really doing harm. I would love to talk more about that particular instance, because I think when you are feeling a lot of fear or you have some wounds that make you extra sensitive to whatever's happening in the room, what can you do in the moment to choose unity when it feels like all you can really access is that scared, like defensive feeling?
That's a hard one. And that's a good one. And a real one. I think we do. I'm thinking even as you say that of our Sunday school class last week. And I think we do meet that more often than not, frankly. My personal experience has been that the first place I need to go is to my own heart and make sure that before I say or do anything, my own heart is right. If my heart is right, probably what I do is going to be pretty good. If my heart is off or angry or hurt in a way that feels vengeful or like lashing out, then whatever I do probably is not going to work very well. So my own heart has got to be the starting place, which I think is subsequent to and responsive to the example of the Savior. He was pretty affirmative with his corrections on many occasions, but his heart was so flawless that it was right and it worked and it served the greater good and the good of the person who received the correction. But without my heart being right, then I better tread pretty slowly and purify that first, take responsibility for myself first. With regard to the soloist, it occurred to me afterwards, in a recent performance with one woman who was just so loud, it was objectionable. It was really an offense to the music. But I thought, you know, how much better would it have been if we could have anticipated that we know that woman, we knew her well enough in advance, had invested in her enough in advance that we had become acquainted. We knew something about her dispositions and about her desire to belong in a very personal, individual, one person way. And we had simply invited her to sing a solo.
Wow.
Heading it off at the pass, right? Yeah. Wouldn't that have been lovely? Wouldn't that have been lovely? But that would have required us to have done some serious front end work and some follow-up work and perhaps receive some inspiration to see a way to make that work. Yeah. Meeting people where they are on their own terms. As you know, I just returned from this world tour trip with the Tabernacle Choir and Orchestra to the Philippines. I've just been back a few days, hence the bags under my eyes. In any event, it was the first time the choir and orchestra had ever been to the Philippines, only the second time they'd ever even been to Asia. And the previous visit was 40 years ago to Japan. So this was a timely kind of a visit, ambitious to take 400 plus people with all the equipment all the way across to the other side of the world, but really beautiful.
And Kathy's sort of like the goodwill ambassador.
I do have a great job.
Yeah.
Hostess. Oh. And I kind of get to define it as I go. Welcoming all the people who come. Not so much there. They're doing their own thing there. But anyone who comes to the Tabernacle for the rehearsals on Thursday evenings or the broadcast on Sunday morning, I have the great pleasure of greeting at the door and with the help of the sister missionaries from the Temple Square Mission, helping them find seats and assuring that they feel welcome, however they look and whoever they are and fresh off the slopes or whatever it is. We're glad to see them. I love it. Great job. Mm-hmm. In any event.
Thank you so much. I think that's such a good place to go when you're in that moment and you're recognizing fear, because I think for me, a lot of the pressure in those situations is that I feel like there's this urgency and I have to hurry and do something. Yeah. And I love the idea that maybe this isn't mine to do. Like if I have some purifying to do in my own heart or I need or have wounds that need my attention, then it's not mine to take care of the class in that moment. Because I'm probably going to do it recklessly and it's okay to just turn inward and handle that. And I love the idea that even that situation, even when it is this kind of internal conversation that you're having, that even that can be this real opportunity to grow and stretch. And maybe that's one more reason why it's so useful to be a ward choir where everybody's going to bring something different, because it really means that we're going to be growing together in this unity that is never in unison.
Yeah. The visual effect and the emotional effect, the heart effect, even if it's not really easy on the ears, is going to be better, more consistent with the worship, which is what we're there for. We're not there for performance. We're there for worship, right?
Yeah. Kathy, could you share the other story that you bring up in your essay? It's kind of a funny one about your brothers-in-law.
It's a true one.
And they're saying, could you share that? And I think there's some interesting metaphor to explore there as well.
Actually. Thank you. Yes. So I'm married to the oldest of four brothers, and they were a very tight boy band in a literal and figurative way. These California dudes, in any event. They all played guitars and had perfected their craft as a quartet. And, you know, a quartet's four voices. So I was the first woman to be brought into this mix as the girlfriend of the oldest brother. And when he took me home to Southern California to this home and they wanted to put their best foot forward, they got out their guitars and their bass and were going to perform for me. Well, I love music and I love to sing and I do harmonies and I do melodies and, you know, I just like it. And it was this communal kind of thing. I was kind of feeling the kumbaya. So here we were sitting with the four of them and their parents. And I mean, that soprano note, that melody, it just begged for my voice. So I joined in. And the one brother who has a beautiful tenor voice looked at me askance and I could tell something was wrong. And then I realized with just a bit of reflection that this was his note. He'd been singing this for the whole life of the band. And who was I to take his note? And everybody who loves a quartet loves his own note and doesn't necessarily want someone in his space. And he really didn't want me doing what he had been doing for all these years. But so I hesitated, recognizing the unhappiness. I had a bigger goal in his mind, and that was his brother. So I didn't want to offend the family upset my bigger cause, which in the church focus would be the worship and the camaraderie and the brotherhood and the sisterhood and the children of God and the pleasing heaven and all of that would be the bigger purpose. Well, I didn't want to offend his brother by offending his brother. Anyway, so I thought, what's my way forward? One was just sit quietly and smile at the boys, a la Barbie movie, you know? Or another thought that came to me that seemed a little more palatable was look for another note. You do harmonies. You can hear harmonies. So they've got four things going there, but there's another note in there somewhere. So I branched out and picked a descant that was up a little higher than any of them could go. And he looked at me approvingly like, okay, you're part of the band. And to this day, all these 50 years later, I've been married 50 years. All these 50 years later, we still jockey for position a bit when we start singing, because this isn't scripted, you know, just like church isn't scripted. So we jockey for position a little bit here and there. But I love him and he loves me. And I know that. I know that he loves me. And he knows that I love him. And if I take his note, it was inadvertent. And if he takes mine, that was inadvertent too. I'm not looking to give offense or to take his space. I love his space. I love his voice. And I'll find another one. Just give me a minute.
Yeah.
And give me time to make it right. And then I try to find another note. And to this day, we make music together with the same kind of bit of tension, but commitment to and allegiance to each other as a brother and sister.
Yeah. That's an awesome story. And it's definitely resonant for me as someone that has felt sort of the temptation to just say, okay, I'm going to sit back. Like, I'm not going to bring my gifts. That can certainly be easier than finding the descant, than finding the way that I can add, you know, especially in a church community, where at times I've felt like a little bit different, you know? And I guess I also want to say, even though I want to take that to heart, because I feel like I've got, I don't know if the word is confidence, but I'm in a place emotionally where I can probably like handle that. At the same time, I want to recognize that I'm in our church community, at least, like I'm in the racial majority. Mm. I'm in the sexual majority. And so it is easier in some cases for people like me to make room for myself. I want to like flip it around a little bit and say, how can we, if we're now the brothers in the metaphor, how can we make sure that we are making it, I don't want to say easy because I don't think ease is typically the goal, but how can we be welcoming to people who haven't found their note yet?
Such a great question. I love that. And it calls to my mind the image of the Savior reaching out to the drowning Peter. You know, how can we reach out if someone's drowning, right? Yeah. And again, back to the Philippines thing, it calls to my mind something that I observed there that I had a hint was going to occur, but I hadn't understood the power and the import of it until I watched it happen. The choir had learned several songs in Tagalog. And as they began to sing, and it was with no small effort on their part. I mean, nobody speaks Tagalog, honestly. Well, I shouldn't say that. There's one fellow in the choir who's a Filipino. Oh. And there was one sister in the choir who served a mission there and apparently really mastered the language. So she tutored the women, he tutored the men. And through blood, sweat, and tears, those people learned that language well enough that I understand that it was really comprehensible and credible. It was good. So they sang several songs in Tagalog. And in fact, after the whole grand performance, the final encore, which typically is something grand, was a Tagalog song that was the effectively the same as Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star or Row, Row, Row Your Boat. It was a song that those Tagalog two-year-olds learn on their mommies and daddy's laps. And they all know it in their hearts and souls and forevermore. So it goes straight to their hearts. It's about vegetables, for Pete's sakes. And the little tiny Filipino house and the vegetable garden and the rain that falls and the nourishment. And if you eat your vegetables, you'll be strong, you know? Yeah. So it has no grand gospel message, But it goes straight to their hearts, straight to their hearts, because it's a song from their mommy's or daddy's lap. Well, the choir effectively reached out their hand and met them on their terms, in their language, in their vernacular, with a song that was their childhood, their home life, them.
Yeah.
And I think, figuratively speaking, if we could do more of that in the church, we would all be happier.
Yeah.
Those of us who were doing the reaching would be sanctified and feel better about ourselves. We'd be shedding the natural man and embracing the best of who we are and who we desire to be. And those who were rescued would come up for air. Mm. But I think we got to extend ourselves and rehearse in another language.
Yeah.
And put ourselves through the paces to pronounce it right so that it speaks to that person and they can understand it.
Love that.
And I think it's a language of, it's a shift in the language from the language of judgment to the language of curiosity. I think that is so important, that rather than react with fear to something that we don't understand, react with curiosity. I think in those conversations, that those uncomfortable conversations in church, typically for me, when that comment is made, if I can say, I can see that this comment came actually from fear, and I can feel that same thing in myself, or it's sort of hitting at some core vulnerability. It could be your sense of belonging. By that comment, now I don't feel like I belong. So that's a core vulnerability, right? Mm-hmm. Security and belonging, those kinds of things. That's where those comments often come from. And that's also what it's triggering in us. So if we can see ourselves in that comment that's made, I think that's a real skill. And that is like actually opening ourselves up to curiosity about what's going on inside ourselves and what's going on inside of them.
I love that. I think it's...
Oh, can I just add? I've noticed the opposite is also totally true, but sometimes I shut that down. But sometimes someone will share something and you can just feel their heart. This has happened so many times on the podcast where like the words they're saying, I'm like, I don't know about that. Like, I don't know if that totally resonates with me, but you can feel that it is coming from this place that I recognize. And like, I very often feel like I want to choose to resist it because I'm not sure I totally agree. And I love the idea that maybe this operating less from this mind space and leaning into heart can look like just loving that common ground, this common ground of like genuine love. And when that's offered, when a comment is made that's offered in love, maybe that's enough. And we can just enjoy the fact that we're all in the choir and they see it differently, but like there's something really important that we have in common. And you can feel that when people, I think when they, sometimes it's when someone is especially vulnerable, but also sometimes when they're just sharing something that you can tell that they feel so deeply. And I love the idea that that can be as far as it goes. You don't have to agree specifically. You can agree with that heart space.
I was just going to say, we've been talking about Jonathan Haidt's work on moral foundations a lot recently. Yeah. And I think engaging your own curiosity about what moral virtue someone might be displaying when they're making a comment that you don't agree with can open up that heart space more. One of the things that Haidt's research shows is that people who are typically more on the liberal progressive end of the spectrum tend to value care and fairness as their moral foundations more so than people on the conservative end of the spectrum, who have a little bit more even distribution, but are much higher weighted on authority and loyalty and purity. And so I think it can be useful. And certainly people, including us, everyone speaks from fear a lot of the time. But when we hear something we disagree with, instead of, I think a lot of times we want to sort them into the, okay, they're the other, like they're, you know, they're the villain, they're on the bad side, to say like, what's the virtue that they're displaying? What moral foundation are they coming from? Oh, maybe it's, you know, they really value loyalty, and I can see why what they're saying there really is a sort of morally virtuous comment for them. Yeah. Maybe I don't value loyalty as highly, and what they're saying seems to offend my sense of care, you know. And sort of like I think it can help to attribute, you know, these differences a lot of times to things that people to virtues that people feel very, very deeply.
Cooperative with that. That's so beautiful, Tim. Cooperative with that, I think, is the quest to seek additional understanding, which involves questioning. And how fortunate of you, Aubrey, that when you feel that sense of, I'm not sure I'm quite at home with that, you sit in that chair with that microphone and that license to ask a question. How did you get there? Why do you feel that way? The why kinds of questions, with a genuine openness of heart and a willingness to change, to adjust your personal opinion, or to modify the balance between your allegiance to fairness and loyalty. And embrace both still, but maybe you're going to modify your balance a little bit, or in certain circumstances you may. So the power of questioning with open-heartedness is just inexpressible. Sometimes we can't go right to the person to ask questions. I mean, they say 10 questions to every one pronouncement. I think that may be a good formula.
I like that.
Yeah.
In order to inform ourselves before we make a pronouncement.
Yeah.
And sometimes we can go right to the question if she's sitting here and you're sitting there. But on other occasions, we may not have access to that person. But we can do things to inform ourselves more broadly, seek additional input besides a given podcast or a given news channel or a given newspaper, whatever it is.
This is going to confirm what we already
believe. Drill down. Don't drill down on it. Force ourselves to subscribe to other magazines, to listen to other podcasts, to have our speed dial set to both NPR and Fox, and go back and forth to find wherever we fit within the middle, and to be willing to move back and forth, responsive to a truth that's really more resonant and more robust.
Yeah.
And I think then we get to a better place of understanding and of welcome.
That's right.
Were you going to say something, Bill?
No.
Okay, but it comes back to you. I was just going to say, this is something, Bill, actually, that you have really have been a mentor for us in this exact space, actually, that I think this is kind of what you're saying too, Kathy, that I think sometimes that it's the questions that are so much more powerful than even the response from the person, that sometimes even if you're internally just like asking the questions, that just puts your mind in a totally different place. And a lot of times I think that opens up onto something that's even more important than whatever they literally say to you as a response. That's something really powerful that we've learned in these conversations, that choosing to ask a question instead of shut down the conversation, which is really an impulse for me. I go one of two places. And I have had this thought on the podcast that someone may say something, I have this knee-jerk reaction, I'm just going to cut that. I'm just going to cut that later, which I don't do. But like, I have that response. And
we've
that
given Aubrey too much power, frankly.
You'll never know. That's a way to shut down. I'm shutting down the curiosity. And I'm like, I'm going to dismiss what they say. And I don't like it so much that we're just going to take it out of the conversation. Or sometimes the opposite. I feel like I shut myself down. I feel bad. I feel wrong. Like they see it so differently. I must be wrong. And that's also the end of the conversation. And it feels so powerful to make that choice to be curious and just keep asking questions while it feels uncomfortable, because my experience has been that you always arrive at something that's more wise than that instant end of conversation. Either you're wrong or I was wrong. Yeah. So thank you, Bill.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I'm as guilty as anyone probably I've worked on this. So I know what it's like to when most of the information that you choose to engage is simply confirming your beliefs and biases. It's a really unhealthy place to be, but it's where most of us are. If you look at our society, that's most of us where we are most of the time. And so Kathy's challenge there is real. I mean, it's actually really important that each of us do that.
Yeah.
Really look at how much of our time do we spend engaging, welcoming information that merely confirms and makes us feel good about how we look at the world. And are we really willing to be uncomfortable and change our views of things? Are we actually curious?
Well, how have you cultivated it? Can you get concrete at all? Because it's so hard.
Yeah.
You can definitely give nods to discomfort and openness to change, but like actually doing it is so uncomfortable.
It is uncomfortable. I think for me, it's more like I'm really curious about what my neighbors, how they look at the world. Mm-hmm. You know, we're pretty good in our faith community about uniting around something bigger that transcends these differences. But it's also interesting to me to see how people really look at the world. And sometimes it's kind of disturbing. You'll unearth, you'll think a person, you know, like your neighbor, you'll be talking to a neighbor and you'll just open this little door and then you find out, oh, they believe in this like really strange conspiracy theory or whatever, you know. But actually, what I found is that if I can be curious about that and just ask, oh, how did they get to believe this thing? There's a story there, right? And it's understandable. Their life experience, and you can understand how they got to this very different place. I just think that's been a discipline. And not judge, but be curious about it.
Yeah,
it's something we can all do.
That's really interesting. Getting it from the idea or the sort of proposition into the story is sort of the same thing as getting it from mind into heart. You know, very very strong correlation.
Yeah, there. Yeah, same thing.
Yeah,
yeah, I love that.
Sometimes I notice in myself that I feel like I want to seek validation or comfort, but in my wiser moments, and if I rethink that, that's really too low an objective. That's shooting really low. Shooting higher is growth, and growth is less comfortable than is status quo. But status quo isn't really what I'm seeking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not. And my better self is seeking growth, which means discomfort.
Yeah.
So if I'm seeking discomfort, then I'm going to put myself beyond what is my comfortable place. And that's where I listen to Fox News until I think I understand their point of view. Mm-hmm. Then I quick push the button right next to it on my radio, and I listen to CNN until I think I get what they're saying. And then I try somebody else, NPR, or MSNBC. I have them all right there in a row. If anybody looked at my radio, they'd wonder, who is this woman? Wow. Has she got an identity crisis going on? Maybe I do. Maybe I do. Because I want a big identity. Mm. I want to broaden my identity, not narrow it. Right? And I also think the other secret weapon to broadening identity is just asking more questions before we rush to judgment. I love this story of my friend who is a Texan, and she and her Texas mom were in a grocery store standing behind a person at the checkout stand, which is kind of an intimate place. You see everything they bought and wonder what they've got in mind, you know, in any event, excuse me. She was grumpy and imposing that grumpiness on the checker, and just had a million complaints to register and negative things to say. And this friend of mine, to her credit, admitted this. She leaned over to her mother and put her hand up to her mouth and said, I think she ought to go back to aisle two and buy a little bit of niceness. And the mother, without missing a beat, stepped forward and put her hand on the shoulder of that checker. And she said, you having a bad day, precious? With her Texas accent. And that woman burst into tears and began sharing the horrors of her moment. She was the whole sum of her moment, of all the experiences that had brought her to this place, literally and in her head. And with just the slightest scratch of a surface, out came all of this eagerness to share. And those two women to this day are friends. Instead of this judgment in her face, it was one of, let me ask a question. I think I don't understand. There must be more to this than meets the eye. And it didn't require much for that invitation to be answered with some connection.
Yeah.
I love that story. Really, and I totally believe that that's almost always the case, that if you ask enough questions, you always eventually get to a place with someone where you can, there's nothing you can do but love, because it's so tender. And you, when you understand that, then you can only feel compassion. So I loved that story. I keep thinking about this moment it was in a conversation with Patrick Mason months or years ago. I don't remember when this was, where we were talking about this concept of a four-stage church and having everybody coming with wherever they are developmentally and in their faith journeys and being Zion. And I asked him something like, but wouldn't it be better if everybody was in the what I saw as the last stage, the harmony stage? And Patrick very quickly was like, but don't you think somebody in any other stage would think that that's Zion, that in simplicity, that it would be Zion if everybody was in simplicity? And if you're in perplexity, it's Zion when everybody agrees and you're in perplexity. And it was just so obvious, but had never crossed my mind. And so that has really changed the way I see I see my ward, even that maybe this is what we're going for. We're not trying to be, we're really not trying to be the same, and it wouldn't actually be better. But as we sort of start wrapping up, I would love to just hear from you both. Like, what is the actual vision? What is the vision on a Sunday? What could it really look like to be totally unified in all of our imperfections and with all of our different, our tendencies, maybe for the way we show up and sing in a ward choir? How can we really create this Zion community on a Sunday?
I think one of the things that we do that's not particularly helpful mm-hmm. is a lot of church is about sitting in rows and we're like diagramming ideas and putting ideas on a board. And it's a very kind of a heady experience. Yeah. But I think a lot of what happens, I think what's really powerful about the way we do religion in the Latter-day Saint Church. So can I share just a brief story?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's actually my essay, but this is, I moved into a ward when we moved to Midway, Utah. And, you sit in elders quorum. I went at my first elders quorum meeting and you try to get a sense for the people who are in your groups. Like you just like listening to comments, you're trying to get a sense of who your fellow quorum members are. And I remember one, kind of an older gentleman, he made a comment and that I thought particularly seemed a little narrow-minded, and I just sort of imposed like this immediate judgment. And I just, mm-hmm. I feel like, oh, we're probably not going to be great friends. And then at the end of these discussions, I'm not like this huge fan of these discussions we have necessarily, but they can be good. They can be good.
Yeah.
But at the end, the elders quorum president stood up and said, oh, by the way, we have cannery assignments this week. And guess whose hand shot up first? This guy who had made this comment. His hand goes up immediately. And I thought, okay, so I hurried up, put my hand up, snagged the last assignment. There were three, right? Because they go fast. And so because I wanted, my impulse was, okay, I need to get to know this person better. I'm so grateful that I acted on that impulse. So we have these opportunities in the church to actually serve together. Yeah. And it's not about these concepts that we drop on boards and discuss endlessly. It's actually serving together in something that's very simple, but it's something that we can unite around. And in the act of serving, I got to know the real person here. We drove down together. We drove back together. We worked together. And we became fast friends. I don't see the world the same as this fellow does still, but I've gotten to see all kinds of dimensions in him that my judgment would have precluded me from seeing. So we do these, we need to do more of this. We need to sing more in these ward choirs. We need to, it's inconvenient. Like our ward choir, we have to rehearse at like 10:45. It makes Sunday so long. We need to do these things. We need to work together on these projects. I'm afraid we do less of it than we used to. And it concerns mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. I think we do need to do more of it. That's where we see each other's humanity. And that's where we can transcend these differences where ideas divide us. Uniting in just some simple project together and that is a strength that's traditionally been a strength of our faith, and it needs to be.
Love yeah that. Yeah, thank you.
Unison by very linguistic and musical definition is one, and one is easier than infinity. It's just easier. It's simpler to get your brain around and simple to comprehend in a thousand ways, but there are places when it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. In our worship services, there are times when we all are united around a project or a cause or an idea, and we're one. It's sometimes a fleeting moment, but we've all experienced that on occasion, right? Maybe we bow our heads and somebody says something that everybody just feels like that represents me and represents her and connects us all to heaven together. We've all experienced those moments, and they're precious and probably few, but they're real. But it's not the whole nature of what we do or who we want to even be. There's more texture and more nuance and more breadth to what we're seeking, which is broad chords and key changes and loud mm-hmm. passages and soft passages and pauses where no one sings at all. All of it is what makes a masterpiece. So I think the musical metaphor serves for what we're seeking to do at church and everywhere else. And I would applaud the occasions that bring us together and encourage our taking advantage of them, and salute Bill as an example of a person who, across the whole of his whole life, beginning as a young man, has embraced those opportunities, and look at what he's become, a man who thinks broadly and contributes deeply. And I don't doubt that that was tutored from early on, from his raising his hand to go with a guy that he didn't even like. He didn't approve of exactly at first glance. But with exposure and shared project and uniformity of commitment, allegiance to a worthy cause, they grew together. I don't know that he shares his opinions still or yet or ever will, but obviously he learned something and became something in the process of embracing that man and going to where he was going to be and hearing him, asking questions undoubtedly. And clearly, this may be an aside, but I'm a real devotee of your podcast. I think I've listened to almost everyone except the ones that have been posted since I was gone to the Philippines. So I would continue to tune in. This one will be the cringiest one of all. But there haven't been any other cringy ones. But in any event, just candidly and in an intimate way, I would say I've watched you two become more over the course of what you've done. You were terrific from the start, but you're better now.
Thank you.
You're better individually. You're better as a pair. And you're better with the people you talk to. Very apparent to a completely uninvolved, unemotional, non-knowing person who's listened and watched the evolution of your becoming. And it's very real. And I think it's because of exactly what we're talking about today. You're showing up at the choir and you're offering your voices such as they are. And you may sometimes think, oh, wish I hadn't said that, or I wish I'd said that better. But you keep singing. And you keep asking questions, which I think is key. Keep listening to the others. Any person singing in a choir who can hear his or her own voice better than anybody else's is just not cooperating. There's no unity. There's a division if all you hear is yourself. Yeah. So you got to keep listening in order to create the desired effect. And the final thing, when I was a little girl, I attended Easter service with my grandparents and my parents every single Sunday at the First Presbyterian Church on South Temple. You know it, that great big beautiful one, just a few doors from the Cathedral of the Madeleine. In any event, I'll never forget a sermon I heard when I was a young girl, when that fellow, the minister there, stood up and in a call and response fashion, which was the norm of the preaching style, we had a book that told us what we were supposed to say in response to what he said from the pulpit. He gave a beautiful introduction about the Savior and all he'd done in our behalf and all the promises that were implicit in that. And then he said, and as a result, because of Jesus, who won? And then we all in full voices said, which I just love the license of, we won. And then he'd say, and we will never die again because of his resurrection. So who won? And we'd say, we won. And he'd say, there are lots of injustices in the world and life isn't fair. But at the end of the day, who won? And we'd say, we won. And I would say, with regard to our unity as wannabe disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ, that if we hang on to his coattails and follow his example and make it right when we've done it wrong, that ultimately we will win and we will in fact be one, which is the goal.
Thank you so much.
Beautiful place to end.
Yeah, both of you.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Kathy. Thank you for sharing your hearts here. It's really meaningful.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. We really hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Kathy and Bill. Wayfair Magazine just published both Kathy and Bill's essays, so you can find them at wayfairmagazine.org. That's W-A-Y-F-A-R-E magazine.org. And while you're there, make sure that you subscribe if you haven't already. You can also pick up the book, No Division Among You, on Amazon or a Deseret Book. And if the topic of peace building is resonating with you, we would really recommend that you check out this new podcast that Faith Matters is co-sponsoring in collaboration with Mormon Women for Ethical Government called Proclaim Peace. It's hosted by Patrick Mason and MWEG co-executive director Jennifer Thomas. It's such a great podcast, and you can find it and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks, as always, for listening. And remember, you can check out more at faithmatters.org.